Hello, good morning and welcome. I'm Alec Hogg and this is the Biz News Briefing. Three studio guests for you today. Faan van der Walt from We Buy Cars with a trading statement that came out yesterday. He can explain to us exactly how it, what it means, because the top line looks great. The bottom line headline earnings, not so great, but there's lots of insights there. And then the chaos in South African rugby continues. Zelf Marais is a man who's been shouting against it for ages, particularly when Western Province Rugby Union was being sold. He is against it. We'll find out why and why he's been suspended by SARU. And Corky Koyman on the chaos, lots of chaos today, that is Sasfin Bank, which appears now to finally have reached the end of its life as a JSE-listed company. We'll understand what yesterday's belated financial results actually mean. First, let's pick up with the news headlines. Here are our partners at Bloomberg. General Motors in
That was after the automaker signaled solid U.S. demand for its high-margin vehicles. GM posted better-than-expected results for the latest quarter and raised the low end of its full-year profit forecast. Now, despite the strong showing stateside, Bloomberg's Craig Trudell tells us GM is struggling in China.
I think they are trying to really sort of get their act together and recalibrate what that business is going to be going forward. And I think in broad strokes, what they want to do is stop competing in this sort of very competitive, you know, middle market there. They have a really strong business of low-priced vehicles, a business called Wuling that does quite well, and they want to try and move up market.
That is Bloomberg's Craig Trudell reporting. We go to Tesla next. The company is set to report third quarter results. We have a preview now from Bloomberg's Charlie Pellett.
Investors will be focused on the electric vehicle maker's autonomous gross margins and forward-looking guidance. CEO Elon Musk made a big bet on autonomous vehicles and unveiled the company's dedicated robo-taxi on October 10th, but the event was light on details. The Austin-based company sold 1.8 million cars globally in 2023, while sales perked up in the third quarter thanks to strong deliveries in China. Tesla is facing its first potential year-over-year decline. In New York, Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.
The International Monetary Fund is boosting its growth forecast for the U.S. next year. However, the IMF cut its estimate for the rest of the world by a tenth of 1%. That growth rate now forecast to be 3.2%. At the same time, the fund is forecasting inflation globally will slow to a rate of 4.3% next year. That would be down from 5.8% in 2024. And the fund gave credit to the central banks of the world for taming inflation without sending nations into recession. Here is ECB President Christine Lagarde.
It looks very much that inflation is on the right track of disinflation. You know, we come from very high numbers, as high on average for the whole of the euro area as 10.6%. And the latest reading we had in for the inflation in September was 1.7.
Christine Lagarde there, the head of the ECB, speaking earlier to Bloomberg in Washington, where the annual meetings of the World Bank and the IMF are underway.
Well, big stuff happening around the world. In Australia, Kinetico Energy today released the results of its drilling in Mpumalanga, and the first of five holes that it drilled is not commercially viable. So the share price down 52%. We really like Kinetico. It's in the Biz News model portfolio, and you probably got a better chance now of investing in that one. Just generally having a look at the major stocks that are in our portfolios. Palantir continues to go higher. That was 0.5% stronger. Amazon 0.33% stronger. ASML has picked up. It's a 1% better. IBM 0.25%. And these are all from the US. And just closing off on the US markets last night, S&P 500 index was down by 0.1%. And the NASDAQ was up by 0.25%. But much more interesting right now here in a local sense is what is going on with We Buy Cars. Now, Faan van der Walt joins us. Morning, Faan. Lovely to have you on the Biz News Briefing.
Good morning, Alec. Thank you for having me.
You guys have been getting quite a lot of support from the Biz News community, not least Walter Aylett, who tells me he bought big in We Buy Cars ahead of the listing, and he really loves your company. He did say, though, that he felt that at 35 Rand, it seemed to have run a little bit hard. I know you guys aren't supposed to be looking at the share price, but can you give us a sense of where you're seeing it?
Yes, look, this is new to me, being a listed company, and it's interesting to monitor the share price and see what people think. You're right, it did well. I think the initial trades happened at around 20 Rand, and it recently hit 35 Rand. It's certainly not one of our goals to try and raise the share price or influence the share price. What we are focused on is delivering good results, and that's our core focus. We certainly not one of these companies who puts a digital scroll when you walk into head office displaying the share price. So that's certainly not the focus. Sometimes you see it's down 10% and then it's up and nothing has changed in the company and you wonder why, what happened, why did people sell, why did people buy? But I guess that's supply and demand, and you know the value of a listed entity is what the shareholders are willing to pay for shares.
Well, you're going to be meeting a guy called Nick de Blok at the Biz News conference in March. We're in fact putting out the opening for bookings today. And Nick is the CEO of Kinetico, and Kinetico's share price is down 32% right now in Australia. So I guess the 10% here and there is easy going. Just from your side, though, yesterday you brought out a trading statement. So it's not your financial results, but it is telling shareholders what they can anticipate. And at the top line, it looks very healthy, more than 20% growth. But with headline earnings per share, it's actually gone backwards by about two-thirds. So those are big disparities. And that's why I wanted to ask you, given there's so much interest in your company amongst the Biz News tribe, exactly if you can just unpack that for us so we can understand it better.
Sure. Let's start by just saying the financial year end for We Buy Cars is in September. So we've recently ended our previous financial year. So the auditors are busy. We're nearly finalizing our results. So that will be made public on the 18th of November. But according to JSE regulation, you have to notify shareholders if you're up or down, or you anticipate being up or down more than a certain percentage. That's why yesterday we did send out a SENS explaining in detail what that's going to be. In our case, it's positive news mostly, but you're absolutely right. We need to explain and why there are a difference between our core headline earnings and our basic earnings, and that's got to do with the listing. So there's two major amounts that will be non-cash, non-recurring. It's financial provisions that were in the books. One firstly was to do with a call option derivative. When Dirk and myself was still shareholders in We Buy Cars in our personal capacities or in our companies together with Transaction Capital. So that amounted to about 426 million, which needed to be provided for in the books, and that was removed. So that's the one big expense, and then there was a listing fee of around 40 million rand. Cash rate, it's made up of many parts, but that's more or less 40 million. So these are non-cash, non-recurring provisions that was there. What's most important to us is that core headline earnings. That means we're doing the volume, we're earning a proper return for the investors, and hopefully next year, you know, you'll see a good set of results which wouldn't include such anomalies.
But it's a proper business. 800 million rand in core headline earnings. That's a big number, up 21%. I was actually, I had to rub my eyes when I saw your figure on how much it costs to list on the stock exchange. More than 40 million rand. No wonder there aren't that many listings nowadays. Is there anything that you could have done to drop that or perhaps shave off some of the advisor fees?
Look, firstly, it was not in my hands as we were a minority shareholder and the controlling shareholder, all the transaction capital, you know, drove that process. But I also questioned that, and I think we did well because I think you can mess up a listing quite easily by trying to save money throughout the process. We had fantastic advisors in the form of Palladis Capital and PSG Capital who assisted us, and also building the relationships with potential investors and just doing things right. So I'm happy with the result. It's never it's always a bit painful, you know, when you employ the right people and the professionals, because you have to pay for that. But I think the results speak for themselves.
Yeah, you have to sell a lot of cars to sort out 40 million rand, and I'm sure that's the way you look at it. Still, having started the company, the other point I'd like you just to explain is 42 million shares going to Coronation Fund managers. So how did that work? Because, well, just take us through. You unbundled WeBuyCars from Transaction Capital, which is probably with hindsight a fantastic thing that you've now extricated yourself from their clutches, because that's a company that seems to be going through a rough patch still. But some of those shares then went to what you call a book build, so people could subscribe for it, but a heck of a lot went to Coronation.
Yes, yeah, that's negotiations that started happening last quarter 2023. And for this listing to take place, you had to go through this whole process. I think it was explained in detail in the pre-listing statement, but yes, they had to take a view on WeBuyCars and commit a certain amount for us to do the deal, and that's what it boils down to. So they were early investors, which made the listing possible.
So Coronation are one of your cornerstones. Walter Aylett and Aylett & Co, another of your cornerstone investors, as Walter proudly told us. Who else are big shareholders now in WeBuyCars?
There aren't many shareholders over 5% or even close to 5%. I think besides those, the PIC has invested significantly in WeBuyCars and lots of pension funds, those sort of shareholders.
So you've got lots of people watching your process, or your progress rather, not just direct investors. And there are a lot of the business community, after Walter said, you're such a great company, you bought in around 30 Rand, and well, they've had a good ride up to 35. But I guess your results are coming out on the 18th of November. Look forward to talking to you then. Look forward to you telling us the WeBuyCars story in March next year at the BizNews conference. But before you go, this 21% at the top line, that's the number we're going to look at, take the accounting out of it. Is this a sustainable figure, the growth?
Yes. I think for the foreseeable future, yes, because you have to look at the size of the market. These are questions that previous stakeholders within WeBuyCars asked me many years ago. How far can you go? How much can you still grow? I vividly recall Michael Mendelevich back in the day when we were just doing over 6,000 cars per month. I said, I'll promise you I'll still be around when we do 10,000. Which seemed very far away, and now currently we're constantly hitting 15,000. As a percentage of the market in South Africa, the NAMSA and the used vehicle registration statistics will show you that, you know, there's around 140,000-150,000 deals a month. So we're still sitting on just into double digits there, so I believe we can certainly grow it. Our ambition is to do around 25,000, so there's still lots of room to grow locally.
Plenty runway there. Fine Van der Walt is the chief executive and co-founder with his brother Dirk of WeBuyCars. Well, while we are looking at WeBuyCars and looking at the local scene, Lots is happening in a place called Kazan in Russia. We've got quite a hectic Russian story to end the program with from our colleagues from our partners at the Financial Times in London. But Sunisha Naidu spoke yesterday with my colleague Chris Stain about the BRICS summit. She's with the Global Institute, and this is very interesting because it puts in perspective why the BRICS summit is so relevant for South Africa, not just being a member, but what BRICS really means.
What do you think we can expect from this summit with regards to increased trade in local currencies?
I think that's the big talking point. Because if you remember, Chris, in the run-up to last year's summit, there was a lot of talk about the BRICS creating a third global reserve currency. I mean, that comes with a lot of different types of structural issues that need to be aligned, etc. And the idea that this BRICS reserve currency, or the BRICS currency, as they were calling it, would be aligned to a kind of a gold standard, you know, that kind of alignment. Of course, you know, we're not there. And I think what has happened in this summit, in the run-up to this summit, there's been a tempering of that kind of argument, that the BRICS are not going to create a third currency. And I don't think they want to create a third currency. And that's the kind of misinterpretation that happens in global debates and in mainstream media. But I think what they really want to do is, like you right pointed out, is to strengthen and instrumentalize the frameworks, as well as the rolling out of some of those piloting projects around the use of localized currency. If you think about India, you know, we look at India, and India has something called RuPay on the go. And RuPay is a very interesting a payment system that is used with countries in, they use it internally as well as they can use it now externally. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I stand corrected, Iran and India are looking at that space of localizing the credit payment system in terms of how you use the RuPay. Same with China. China is using a lot of its renminbi or its currency in terms of bilateral trade transactions. And I think this helps to also move away or lessen dependence on volatility in financial markets, because if you think about the fact that the dollar is also caught within this the space of how, you know, what happens in the upcoming US elections are going to be critical in terms of what happens to the global financial markets, as well as in terms of the global economy, having these kinds of options on the table for the BRICS countries is going to be key. So listening to President Putin yesterday deliver his inaugural address to the BRICS Business Council, he spoke about something very interesting. He did speak about economic diplomacy. He calls it economic sovereignty. And I think economic sovereignty tells you that having a credit payment system, looking at how logistics having a subgroup of transport logistics with regard to shipping lanes and maritime security around economic and commercial lanes, choke points are going to be critical. Looking at how you may use perhaps the kind of dynamic of creating a BRICS credit payment system, a BRICS credit kind of rating system. All of this is about this notion that if you start moving away, not moving away, but lessen dependency, because dependency is what ties you and locks you into this current global financial markets. And this current financial global markets are also kind of very highly volatile. And so we're hearing that, you know, the next coming global economic crisis is going to be around the debt issue.
That's Sunisha Naidu talking to my colleague Chris Stain on BRICS. Well, as interesting from a South African perspective, it's what's going on in rugby. It's a warm welcome to Zelt Mare. He is the former chairman of the Western Province Rugby Union. Zelt, lovely having you on the program. I know that you've been fighting the system and you've paid pretty heavily for it, but at last it seems as though what you've been predicting or what you've been exposing is getting a wider audience. I see yesterday on News 24, they said, maybe you've been right all along. Been right about what? Tell us what you've been right about.
Alec, good morning to you, and thank you very much for allowing me, and of course, good morning to the listeners, everything here. Now, just one correction, not the former chairperson. The chairperson is on the board of directors of Western Rugby. I'm the president of Western Province Rugby that oversees the clubs and the schools, which is ultimately the shareholder of the professional, on the ultimate shareholder. But of course, the board and things, they will run professional rugby. And you would probably look back, actually, all the noise and things was regarding the professional rugby and thing, and how self-made Mr. Professional Rugby. And I'm not in charge of professional rugby. But that is the smearing things. And add on yesterday, News 24, I don't know if you read the Deputy NFL Business Base introduction yesterday also. I mean, he's making quite an alarming thing. And I maybe just want to read it as it, because I think everything emanated from the Sunday Times into the Business Day and then flowed into News 24. But News 24, under Adrian Basson, he was the one that dig very deep for a number of years already, going back to 2015 already, even before that. So we need to give credit and thanks to Adrian for doing excellent investigative work in there. But let me just read to what the deputy editor, Sasetso Mosening, wrote in his just introduction. This is quite a long one. So he writes, in an expose that sent ripples through the sports world, this newspaper revealed details of a 75 million rand, 1.3 billion rand deal between the SA Rugby Union and the US private equity outfit. On paper, the deal, which hands Ackley Sports Group ASG a 20% stake, might seem like a savvy move to bolster the coffers. But in reality, it is a deal so flawed that literally almost no one could miss the pitfalls. For starters, the valuation of the Springboks commercial rights is at $375 million, 6.6 billion rand, is a glaring underestimation. When compared with the All Blacks, whose commercial rights were valued at a staggering $2.1 billion by Silver Lake, South's deal looks like a fire sale. The Springboks, with their storied history and global fan base, deserve a valuation that reflects their true value. This deal, however, suggests Saro is selling itself short and by a wide margin. So that is very
sure
damning coming in your Business Day of yesterday.
You're getting a lot of support there, and well done to the Business Day and to Adrian Basson for digging around and supporting you, because it does appear as though there's quite a disconnect there when you compare South African rugby's value or the Springboks' value to the All Blacks' value. But now the public knows about it. Where are we in the process? Is that deal going to be stopped?
If we look in terms of what the seven of the franchises, they wrote to Saro last week, as you could see, actually. And SA Rugby actually was so arrogant in the approach, where Rian Oba also said, no, the meeting will proceed. And it took the Minister of Sport to intervene. Now, I mean, I'm quite concerned when the unions effectively being the owners of, they are the shareholders, where the people that are being employed don't even listen to the shareholder. And that is a big concern in the thing. And we don't know how we deal with these kind of matters. And of course, the people are running probably rugby, I mean, currently, especially the functionaries, they are very questionable posts that they've got in terms of it. And yet they are allowed to manage public funds in terms of it. And that is a big concern. I mean, even the former CEO of Saru, Yuri Ru, he's still in charge of Rugby Africa, Alec, if you don't know that in terms of it. He's heading, I mean, and as a consultant behind the thing, I mean, it's just, how can you allow somebody that, and this is what I questioned. We questioned back in the end of 2021, early 2022. And I was charged for that personally, for spreading misinformation and false. And even last week, Saru slapped a 10-year ban on me. They wanted a life ban on me, saying I'm spreading misinformation.
I saw that. So what does a 10-year ban mean?
A 10-year ban means that I can't be involved in rugby for 10 years.
So
for not taking a single cent from the organization, just making the way the clubs who are the owners again of Western Province Rugby. Now, if we even compare the deal of the Western Province equity sale compared to Saru, now the Western Province professional arm was sold off for negative 120 million rand. not even for a rand, negative 120 million rand. And that compared to what is coming out now in the SARU, because it's the same players who did these deals together. We need to dig a closer dig onto, and we need some of the experts to dig actually, because what we're dealing with here, we are actually robbing our community clubs from where they need the money in order to develop the sport. Because without the community structures, we are going to battle for years to come, because if we're going to destroy this base, then we are doomed for life. Actually, we're looking great on the field now, but once we start breaking down that foundation of us, I mean, it's going to be very bleak for us. And we need to do something and to say, guys, enough is enough.
Zoltan, I spoke last week with Warren Wheatley. He's got an interesting business called Altvest, which is bringing private equity to the public. And Warren said, but hang on, why don't you offer shares to fans, to players? And he said that they'd already approached South African rugby with this. The players had actually approached, former players had approached South African rugby, and they were shown the door. So is that the kind of thing that one needs to be looking at? Because it does appear with all the media coverage that is coming out now that that deal seems dead in the water. And those who've been controlling or running things are certainly going to be held to account more.
And it's very interesting you bring up this again, because more than 10 years ago, I actually made a similar proposal. That time I was probably thinking I was the vice president of Western Pro Rugby, but also chairing the union's finance committee at the time. And we wanted to bring a similar project again. And I said, Rob, can we look into that? And as a CEO, I mean, Rob just shut the door on this thing on us.
Who's Rob?
And we could have been flying by now in terms of Fritzy.
Who's Rob?
Rob Wagner was the former CEO of Eastern Province Professional Rugby, and is also currently still working in SA Rugby, also still some consultant.
All right. So where do you want to see things happening? You've now got this 10-year ban. Thankfully, they can't stop you from talking to me or to the media. What do you see is the most logical process here?
On the ban itself, I mean, we can't leave the ban there, because the ban in itself is unlawful, it's unconstitutional. There's no grounds and reason for it actually, because what I'm doing as a president, I'm protecting the interests of our clubs. And as the elected president, I have a duty to do that, because otherwise I'll be failing in my fiduciary duty not to stand up for the clubs in terms of, and as being a public, well, especially, remember, when you deal with public funds, it's not just a matter of care, it's a matter of extra care that you have to impart on here. And somehow, people don't understand that. They think it's the private assets they're dealing with. It's not the private assets. And this is what we need to get through to our fellow people. When you get appointed and to serve, actually, you're going to have to do extra care. And the fact that there is so little transparency in transactions going through and things getting rushed through. And even the fact that when clubs and probably wanted to speak to me, they threatened the club also with suspension and banning. And it's becoming like it's worse than the apartheid years that we experienced, the draconian life. I mean, it's worrying. And we need our government to intervene here, because we can't carry on like this.
So my question then would be answered in your last sentence. You need government intervention. You need Gate and McKenzie to bash a few heads together. Is there any chance of having a government of sports unity, perhaps, where you guys can sit around a table and talk to each other, or has there just been too much bad blood?
No. Alec, I think we need to have that discussion very soon, basically. Important. I've been open to discussing with everybody, and I'm not allowed to. I've reached out even to Yuri Rule last year, and he said he needs permission from the year before. Or he said he need permission from the executive committee to speak to me, and then apparently they refused to give him permission to speak to me.
Who's they? Who's on that committee? What people? Give me names.
The executive committee. So your executive committee comprises of Mark Alexander, Francois Davis. You've got Annie Bartman, you've got the so those are the elected officials. Then you have independent directors also sitting on there, but they get elected appointed by SARB's executive committee. They are not appointed or elected like we would have in a normal corporate structure by the shareholders. And that is where the disconnect comes in, basically, in terms of it. So even that exco has the power to remove their fellow exco, whereas, I mean, you know, SARB technically is like a private company. So the shareholders should have the power to appoint and to remove their rightful actually. So the shareholders basically almost like they just a lame duck. They got no influence actually, because now you've got the top structure calling all the shots all the time, and they hide behind the phrase of confidentiality. So the shareholder who owns the asset is not getting any information about it, but they are expected to make a decision and vote upon matters, which for me to sound bizarre, completely bizarre.
Zsolt Marais, the former or current president, depending on who you want to believe, of Western Province Rugby, and he's articulated all of that for us. Rugby is not a question of life or death in South Africa. It's much more important than that, to use Bill Shankly's words from Liverpool FC going back many years ago. We're going to be talking to Kwoki Khoiman in a moment on the Sasfin story. But before we get there, one of the BizNews tribe's favorite sons, or well, I can't call him a son, but certainly people who contributes to us, got onto a major platform last week when he was invited to talk with Merrin Somerset-Webb. Now, Merrin is a columnist for Bloomberg. She writes about personal finance and money, and she also does a podcast. And here's what Merrin said to Sean Pesh. Merrin Somerset-Webb with Sean Pesh, who's also going to be at the BizNews conference in March next year. He's a regular at those events. And, well, this kind of praise, well, you can't buy it.
Sean, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Merrin. Lovely to be here.
Now, listen, you have achieved fairly spectacular, as I said, outperformance over the last decade plus, despite being a value fund manager. In a period when being a value fund manager has been an absolutely terrible thing to be. This has been a time for growth, yet somehow you've succeeded as a value manager. So let's talk a little bit about how on earth you've done that.
You know, there are a couple of points. So how have we managed to generate those returns? Well, the first is that we'll typically go where people are less interested, because that's where we find the value. So, you know, we made good money in Japan in recent years. We were quite early into moving into Japan when the world was focused in Japan with Warren Buffett and all of that. You know, we were actually selling and redeploying those assets into China. And so even last month, you know, we had more in China than the US, Hong Kong listed stocks. So I guess there's two ways to make money. The one is you can buy a company that you think is a fabulous business and hold it forever, and that company will compound its earnings. What we prefer to do is find an undervalued business, invest at the right time, ideally the right time, and when the value is fully realized, we will then sell that and compound the capital. Okay, because sometimes you can be stuck in these businesses. You think it's a great business, and look at Nike, look at Estee Lauder, look at, you know, Diageo or Unilever in recent years. You things come unstuck. And so we prefer to compound the capital, and we move the capital around. So we really don't shy away from moving our assets around the world based on where we find value. And we're not scared about turnover either. You know, if I look at some of the best money managers in the world, the likes who've survived and got fantastic track records over multi-decades, not just in recent years, you know, the likes of Paul Tudor Jones and Bruce Kovner and, you know, David Tepper and those guys. Mm. I've never, ever seen a single quote from them about low turnover being the answer.
And that full interview of Sean Pesh's with Merrin Somerset-Webb is available on the BizNews Radio website or on the website itself. Go to BizNews Radio. And it's there right now. Kwoki Khoiman joins us from Denker Capital. Kwoki, lovely to have you. And a big story about Sasfin, which we'll talk about in a moment. But you know Sean well. You guys, did you ever work together?
All those, was it 89? No, he joined later, but I was there 89 from there onwards. And Sean joined after a few years. He was one of the younger recruits then.
At Old Mutual?
Adult Mutual, yeah.
Mm. And he's done well by, I think he went to Alan Gray and then off to worked with Simon Marais and started his own firm, like you did, the same kind of path.
Yeah.
And Denker Capital has retained a very, very high reputation, and particularly due to your exploits in the financial services industry. But right from those years, Corky, going back to the old mutual days, Sasfin was around. It was a bank that is well known. David Shapiro, who's often on the BizNews platforms, actually works for them. But my goodness, those results that finally came out yesterday, long after they should have, tell us they're going to delist. They're having all kinds of trouble. It's a story that I think you best can tell.
Yeah, no, it's a sad story. I've known Sasfin for many, many years. Even when I was at Old Mutual, they were actually pioneering quite a few things. And you'll recall their focus was leasing, office equipment leasing, and had a small office there in I think it was Rosebank, and grew from there. And but funding was always a problem for them. And that's when they did the Max Pollock Fremantle deal, when David Shapiro came aboard and obviously then got a big client base, which at the moment, at that same stage, gave you funding. And it was actually a pretty clever deal at that stage. But obviously the pressure's always when you a single product to grow into something wider. And I've gone back actually this morning and I tried to look at where did things start going wrong. And even in 2010, you can see they were having private equity problems and bad debts from private equity, property-related transactions where they outsourced the private equity again. But the real problem really started coming in 2018-19. And a couple of things went wrong there. And, you know, they were caught in that massive fraud, the money laundering fraud, which also involved gold leaf tobacco, where they actually infiltrated the business and various units of the business and got head of IT and finance and credit control to conspire and work together. And yeah, even to the extent that cabal, if you want to call it, inside the business was able to erase transactions. And from there on, you can see it in the financial results. Suddenly in 2018, the non-performing loans, and I just wrote it down quickly, it's fascinating. 2017, non-performing loans were 249 million, but 2019, it was 726. So it tripled the non-performing loans. So obviously, and I know I spoke to Michael Sassoon regularly at that stage as well. Obviously, at that stage, I'm not sure if they were aware of the fraud already, but you can see there were things going wrong. And so, long story, sadly, when you get to that position where your return on capital is under pressure, you're in the press for the wrong reasons, you start losing stuff. And I think for that reason, they actually gave the wealth management guys more shares and took Sasfin itself as a listed entity out of the public eye, off the JSE. Well, that is still happening. But at the moment, this result now reflects the disposal, the starting and ongoing disposal of what would now be non-core. So the core will be going back to what they used to do, asset finance, specifically leasing, office leasing, and then also the wealth management and business and consumer banking.
So they'll just have those two kind of core businesses, the old Max Pollock for Fremantle, which David Shapiro is very involved in, and of stockbroking, which couldn't have known what was going on, and then the office leasing equipment. But Corky, what about the Al Jazeera expose of the gold smuggling from Zimbabwe, and then that was also laid at Sasfin's door? Is that the same scandal or fraud that you were talking about with gold leaf tobacco?
Yes. So it's still not been much in the public domain, interestingly enough. But I think, and obviously this was happening without them knowing it. And in fact, SARS actually alerted them to that, or more the Reserve Bank, in fact, when the Reserve Bank started noticing these flows in and out of the country, and you know, because these guys were so good at hiding the transactions. And I think from there on, you know, then you start focusing on the wrong things. Well, not on your core business. And I think, and at the moment, they've got the tax case hanging over them where SARS is trying to claim, was it $4 billion, $5 billion, a huge amount for facilitating, well, not willfully, but facilitating the flow of foreign exchange out of the country, which meant SARS cannot collect from those parties. Now, that's going to be a very interesting case in any case, because can a bank be held accountable if a client takes money out of the country that might have been due to SARS? But, yeah, it's sadly, Sasfin was always a fairly conservative business, well-run. But I think when you look back over those years, did desperately try to grow outside of whatever it was its core competencies and just never succeeded. And so you can see the cost-to-income ratio was always a bit too high as they were trying to go with new things. I made a list, but it's a lot of smaller steps that they tried to grow into and it never succeeded. But I think the core was really the bad debt that started hitting them in 2018-19, where obviously there were internal, the credit controls were not good enough.
I worked for a period for ABSA. You'll remember this in the mid-90s. And we had a guy who worked for us called Bob Aldworth. Before I arrived there, he worked for ABSA. And Bob had been previously the managing director of Barclays, which was the biggest and the best bank at the time. He then left under a bit of a cloud, to put it mildly, from Barclays, after he had an affair with a lady called Sandra van der Merwe, who was a lecturer at Wits Business School. Yes. Then he was appointed by ABSA, who didn't know the real story of Barclays. And shortly after I arrived at ABSA, Aldworth had been fired because he was the head of credit. And he had a company called Derwent Cole, which he'd lent money to, but he owned it himself and he'd written off the loan. Is this the same kind of thing that's happening here? When you get a dirty banker, in other words, lend myself money for one of my businesses, if it goes right, great. If it doesn't go right, we'll just write off the loan and no one will know about it.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I don't think we've got, because this was more a syndicate who were actually being controlled by outside parties, and they were actually paid by those parties to facilitate transactions inside the bank to use it as a vehicle. So I think this was actually much bigger, but I think there are two stories here. You are right. Number one is the syndicate using the bank, but number two was just, it looks like there were bad lending transactions. I went back in my notes and you can see that a few times where credit controls were lacking and needed to be sharpened up. And so I think they just had the wrong people.
It's a bit worrying, though, that if a syndicate can infiltrate a bank like Sasfin, surely the appeal of a much bigger bank would be far greater. And here I'm talking about some of the big four. How do we know? You see these things and you can't fudge the figures. The figures have told you, as you've explained now, on what was going on at Sasfin. What do you look for from your side to perhaps give you an early warning signal of malfeasance? And perhaps not only you, but people inside these organizations, who must be trying to, I mean, there's fraud and criminals everywhere, and those have to be a very appealing target for them.
Yeah. Look, in most businesses, you look at the cash flow. And by the way, back at Steinhoff, that was one of the things that was always a warning signal. You know, there was the cash flow wasn't there. But in a bank, it's actually very difficult because you're continuously re-lending your cash flow out. So the main thing we look at is the underwriting, the quality of the underwriting, and that you normally see by the bad debt ratios going up. So initially, there are more provisions being taken than actual write-offs. But even that can for a while be hidden. You'll recall the short sellers who wrote that report against Capitec. They alleged that Capitec were evergreening their loans. Now, evergreening means that, you know, when I can't pay my loan, the bank just comes to me and says, okay, we'll give you a bigger facility or we'll extend your loan period. So that type of thing can be done. It is very dangerous for a bank, but when you start getting in, when you try to do that, and obviously the South African Reserve Bank, the Prudential Authority is very important. They are doing regular investigations on the banks, but as an analyst, the only thing we can do is keep on looking at the ratios. And the ratios normally do give you a warning unless the problem has been hidden for a while, which, you know, then you've got a problem with the integrity of the management, which obviously we do a lot of visits and to try and over time test management. And you don't only visit, let's say, Sasfin. As a team, we try and visit all the banks. In fact, November, again, we've got our regular roadshow where November we're seeing the CEOs and the CFOs of almost, I think, every bank and insurer in South Africa. And then you corroborate the stories. And it's often, we see that overseas as well. Bank A will tell you, well, you know, you should worry about Bank B. Say, oh, what is that? And yeah, so it's just a mosaic theory of getting as much information as you can to try and pick up something that might be wrong. And you do then notice that when you zoom in on that. But hopefully those type of issues, as Sasfin has had, is few and far between, but it does happen. It does happen. And when I look back in 2017, it was very noticeable in the results that things were starting to deteriorate.
What scares me witless as a South African taxpayer is this urging of some people in the public sector to create a state bank. Because if you can do this with a private sector bank, which is family well, I don't say family controlled, but the Sassoon family have been involved there forever, and they couldn't pick it up. Can you imagine that a state organization, and especially as the track record that we've seen in South African state organizations, what could happen there? It's a very complex area, and one where if the criminal syndicates can infiltrate Sasfin, they should be able to infiltrate much more easily a company that's perhaps doesn't have the incentives that the Sassoons would have had.
No, absolutely. I mean, you see that with the Postbank, very good example, but that is just internal incompetency. You see it with, VPS, that is actually, effectively, it was a syndicate who used the bank to enrich themselves. You see it with I forget the name now of the bank in KwaZulu-Natal, which is involved in the school feeding schemes. That's right, Itala. And remember, those amounts are fairly small, but what you get is a state-owned bank who not only wants to go into consumer lending, but more into corporate loans where you can really have big frauds. But the state-owned bank is just, especially at the moment in South Africa, where we just don't seem to be able to get competent people or don't want to appoint competent people into the right positions. You really, for the taxpayers, it'd be the worst thing we could do to start a state-owned bank.
So I'm right to be scared witless about that. Corky Koyman.
Yeah, you're totally right.
Corky Koyman is with Denker Capital. Thank you, Corky, for taking us through the sad Sasfin story, and the numbers that Sasfin delivered yesterday, pretty irrelevant, as he says, because they will be delisting this business from the JSE in the near future. Well, as promised, we're going to close off with something else that is raising some concern. In this morning's FT News briefing, our partners in London had a report that will not go down well amongst the South Africans who are watching from afar what's happening at BRICS. It appears as though Vladimir Putin is trying to bring his friends onto the battlefield, not just as observers, but actually as participants. Let's pick it up from the FT news briefing this morning.
South Korea has strongly urged Russia not to deploy North Korean troops to fight on its side in Ukraine. Seoul says North Korean commandos are already on Russian territory and preparing for battle. Christian Davies has been covering the story for the FT, and he joins me now. Hi, Christian.
Hello.
All right. What do we know so far about the presence of North Korean soldiers in Ukraine?
Last week, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told reporters in Brussels that up to 10,000 North Korean troops were being prepared to be deployed to the war in Ukraine. And that was met with some skepticism with Western officials. However, a couple of days later, the South Korean National Intelligence Service published images it said were satellite images of ships taking North Korean troops to the Russian Far East, where they are allegedly being prepared, kitted out with Russian uniforms, Russian weapons, and even with fake IDs, making it seem as if they are residents of regions of Siberia, with a view to being deployed on the front line. And of course, this would be a very big development, because we're talking about the internationalization and to some extent the globalization of the Ukraine war now.
Well, what has Russia said about these North Korean troops?
I think it's very telling that actually this week the Kremlin dodged the question, saying simply that North Korea is our close neighbor and partner. We are developing our relations in every area and that this is our sovereign right. But they also said this should not raise any concerns for anyone because this cooperation is not directed against third countries, i.e. South Korea or anyone else. Now, of course, South Korea doesn't feel that way. South Korea is worried that in the event of a conflict or a crisis on the Korean Peninsula, that North Korea's support for Russia would be reciprocated.
And I'm also wondering, what does the presence of troops in Russia tell us about where North Korea stands in the world right now?
Well, as recently as 2017, both China and Russia agreed to sign up to very harsh sanctions on North Korea. But that has really fallen apart as the relationship between the US and China, and also the US and Western countries and Russia, has deteriorated in the last few years. This has really given an opportunity for North Korea to emerge from a state of total or near total isolation into having some powerful allies again, like it did during the Cold War. North Korea may not be good at many things, but military hardware, it has some formidable stocks. And actually, those supplies do appear to have made a difference on the battlefield. And so to some extent, we are graduating to the next logical step, which is the provision of soldiers. And of course, giving soldiers as opposed to just military hardware would give Pyongyang much more leverage with Russia in terms of making demands in return.
Christian, what's your takeaway from all this?
I think that conflicts that until relatively recently were seen as quite isolated from each other are increasingly being seen by strategists as linked. In a sense, we are moving back into a Cold War type era where blocs are confronting each other and therefore tensions and crises can easily spread from one part of the world to the next. The question now is, well, Russia is escalating the conflict by, it seems, bringing in North Korean soldiers. And so how are the Western powers going to respond?
Christian Davies is the FT's Seoul bureau chief. Thanks, Christian.
Thank you very much.
That's a hectic story and does really bring into question South Africa's ability to remain non-aligned in a world which is becoming increasingly aligned, and in this case, practically so. We have in this part of the world a reminder of the North Korean 5th Brigade and the chaos that it caused in Zimbabwe soon after independence of that country. Just before we go, results just out on SENS, the Stock Exchange News Service, from Famous Brands. You might know Famous Brands through its brands like Wimpy Steers or Debonair's Pizza. Well, the revenues from the company were up 2% in the 6 months to the end of August. But they are getting their costs under control and somehow managing to grow margins. Headline earnings per share were up 9.5% to 218 cents. And if you own the shares, you can look forward to a dividend of 150 cents a share. And that dividend is an improvement of 9% on what you got last year. Well, this has been the Biz News Briefing, your hour of power every morning. I'm Alec Hogg and look forward to welcoming you back in our company again tomorrow. Thanks to technical producer Ruan Erasmus, executive producer Lucy Ferreira, and yours truly. Until tomorrow, cheerio.